How did Christian communities in the past respond to godless cultures? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is titled Embracing Godly Character, The Christian Community's Response to a Godless Culture. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or learn more about Embracing Godly Character at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Embracing Godly Character, 1-800-325-3040.
No matter what we choose to believe, there's no God who condones taking the life of an innocent human being.
Where I think we are in the culture, but also with religious institutions, is that people have stopped hating us. That is to say, LGBT people. But they're not yet ready to celebrate us. That's the next big work to do.
Maybe it's something as simple as you whistle while you work.
Just whistle while you work.
Mega churches are a house of cards. Mega churches really are the primary example of what's wrong with evangelicalism, why it's so thin, so insubstantial, so unsatisfying.
Southern Illinois truck drivers, the love issues, etc.
If you want to talk big players in the religious landscape, at least in terms of numbers, well, in mainline Protestantism, you're talking about the United Methodist Church. It's, well, getting smaller by the day, but at one time was a massive denomination, a product of, if I'm not mistaken, several mergers of Methodist church bodies, thus the United part of the United Methodist Church, 12 million strong still, and still one of the Seven Sisters of mainline Protestantism. But is it facing a crisis of unity that even the kind of machinations that they have been doing for the last several decades cannot stem, cannot forestall? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 22nd of March. We're going to be talking about the United Methodist Church's crisis of unity. Terry Mattingly, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate, will be our guest for the first half hour. Then Wesley Smith, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, will join us to talk about a declaration in support of conscientious objection in healthcare. It's a needed declaration, especially given the fact that in some countries, MDs are being told that they need to perform procedures like euthanasia on anyone who asks them for it or get out of medicine. Dr. Uwe Simonetta will join us to talk about the secularization of Europe. He's a native of Germany and a former religion editor for United Press International. Then David French will be batting cleanup, senior writer for National Review. We're going to talk about a case heard before the Supreme Court on Tuesday, National Institute of Family and Life Advocates v. Becerra. Should pro-life pregnancy centers be required, in essence, to advertise state-funded abortion in California? We'll take up that subject in the last half hour of Issues Etc. Feel free to join us with questions or comments. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @IssuesETC, and the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the United Methodist Church's crisis of unity, Terry Mattingly, senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College, New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
The United Methodist Church, are they going to have to, if they're going to remain honest, change their name and find some other adjective than United to describe themselves?
Well, that's certainly one way to look at it. I think one of the key elements of what the United Methodist Church is going through right now is that they're trying to find out if it's possible to be united by anything other than their pension plan and some sort of common system for control of their various properties. The other thing that's interesting about the United Methodist situation, especially if you contrast it with the decade or two of headline-grabbing conflicts among Anglicans in the Church of England, is that the United Methodist Church is growing, not declining, if you look at it divided between what's going on in the global South, particularly in Africa, where churches are expanding rapidly, then here within the United States, you have a great deal of difference in terms of the health of the church, depending on regions, something that a theologian and a sociologist back, in the 80s, wrote a paper called The Seven Churches of United Methodism. And they noted that essentially there were different faiths being practiced in different sections of the United States, all with the same signs out in the front yard of the church that said United Methodist. Now, the other thing that makes this story unique and what is going to make it more dramatic is United Methodist polity links the size of annual conferences to the number of votes they get in general conference, which means to some degree, even though the theological left holds the high ground in terms of agencies, seminaries, and many people would say in the House of Bishops, the numbers changing in Africa, the Bible Belt, elsewhere, are shifting the numbers of the votes, which means the left knows that the clock is actually ticking, because United Methodist polity connects the number of votes you have with the health of your region. So that's what makes this story very dramatic, whereas in Anglicanism, the theological left could kind of just play a waiting game. I mean, they were always going to control the House of Bishops. There was no connection between the size of diocese and the number of votes they had. I noted that the famous Diocese of New Hampshire, which of course made global headlines by appointing a non-celibate gay bishop a number of years ago, if you added up every single Episcopal church in New Hampshire on Sunday morning, the total attendance wouldn't equal the size of a single major Episcopal church in some places like Dallas or Houston. So the Methodist clock is ticking loudly, and that's what we're watching now as they're beginning to head. They're less than a year away now from what is supposed to be a special, unique, historic general conference where they're supposed to come up with a plan to keep them united. And the details of that plan and kind of what's led up to it is a very interesting story in the old-lined Protestant world. And frankly, I think has implications for the rest of the Seven Sisters.
What's the dividing issue or issues in the United Methodist Church that they have to deal with here in about a year?
Well, of course, what's been getting headlines for coming up on, 40 years or so has been the battles over homosexuality. But the simple fact is that you come down to language that's in their Book of Discipline, which is essentially doctrinal. And this is not just about homosexuality, it's about marriage and sex itself and how this links then to ordination. So you're dealing with language that basically states that sex outside of marriage is a sin, and thus clergy should not be sexually active unless they are married. And then you define marriage in a traditional way with 2,000 years of Christian teachings, and you've got trouble in sections of the country that are overwhelmingly culturally liberal and theologically liberal in their institutions in those seven different churches of United Methodism. So sexuality gets the headlines, but everybody knows that in a way this is actually about the seminaries. This is actually about the education of clergy, the education of bishops, and the bottom line for it is, how do you maintain some consistent approach to biblical authority in Protestantism? What is the mechanism there? What gives you, to put this in Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox terms, my own church, what gives you tradition with a large T? what gives you the equivalent in Rome, supposedly, of the Pope of Rome, of the chair of St. Peter. If you don't have those mechanisms, how do you settle doctrinal issues except by voting on them? Now, what's interesting, because of these shifting numbers in the United Methodist Church, they have voted over and over and over not to change the doctrines of their church. Yet, at the same time, in a pattern that many people call local option, we're back to that Seven Churches of United Methodism. At the same time, you have people in Colorado interpreting the Bible and interpreting the discipline completely different from people in, I don't know, Northern Alabama or Tennessee or Georgia or anywhere in the Bible Belt. I've been watching all this because I arrived in Denver as a religion reporter in the early 80s, exactly when the first big test of all of this broke out in the Rocky Mountain Annual Conference based in Denver, which would make anyone's short list of the most liberal regional conferences in United Methodism. In the center of it is an institution called the Iliff School of Theology. A former faculty member once told me in the 80s that the Iliff School of Theology is the most liberal institution in America that bothers to call itself Christian, was how he put it. Well, you had a clergy person named Julian Rush, very openly gay, the head of the Colorado AIDS Project, and a United Methodist pastor in good standing in Denver. And basically, he was put on church trial. People around the country were crying that he should be removed from the ministry. And they were dealing with language that said that forbade the ordination and the appointment of self-avowed practicing homosexuals. The key words being self-avowed and practicing. Well, what if when he comes before a board of the Rocky Mountain Annual Conference and they ask him about his sex life, he says, you know, I'd really prefer not to talk about that. Even though he had given dozens of interviews to radio stations, media, newspapers, whatever. But at that moment, in front of the Rocky Mountain Annual Conference, he was not self-avowed. Thus, he's innocent. Right? So you can see how this works. Every single region of United Methodism has been living with a different discipline, a different approach to Scripture, and thus a different approach to, quite frankly, moral theology. It's been a real decade after decade after decade series of running battles.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. About 10 more minutes with him on the other side of the break. When we come back, we will talk about three possible ways forward for the United Methodist Church to retain some semblance of unity, all the while allowing dissenting churches to exit the denomination. Terry's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We're currently faced with a crisis in Christianity, a life and death struggle between orthodoxy and heresy, between the kingdom of Christ and the kingdom of the cults.
The Bible Answer Man, Hank Hanegraaff, talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
The prosperity gospel, it's nothing short of a wholesale transformation of Christianity. It's the glory of the cross supplanted by the glory of consumerism. It's a fast food Christianity. It's long on looks, but it is dreadfully short on substance.
You can meet and hear Hank Hanegraaff at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. You'll find a conference schedule, and you can register at issuesetc.org. Don't miss the premier conference for Christian laity, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday afternoon, we're talking about the United Methodist Church's crisis of unity. Terry Mattingly is our guest. Terry, let's talk about some of the ways that are being proposed within the United Methodist Church to deal with kind of unity slash disunity. You say there are two, maybe three avenues that they've been considering?
Yeah, that was the really interesting event that made me want to write the column I wrote this week. They had an actual statement come out from their House of Bishops that kind of confirmed what everybody had been talking about. Now, I had read that there were three approaches. The bishops say there's two, and then say, oh yeah, maybe there's a third. So here's the three. One would be to formally approve the whole idea of local option. Each section of the church would get to make up its own mind about what the Bible says on crucial issues, but the ones that everybody knows would be the defining issues right now would be, once again, key issues related to homosexuality or sex outside of marriage as traditionally defined would be the way this would be stated in the ancient churches. Now, so you would formally lock into place as law what they've been living under for 40 plus years, which has torn them to shreds. So that seems kind of counterproductive, other than you could all pick to be in a conference that you agree with, and the seven churches or five churches or whatever they are now of United Methodism would just roll on. Now, most people read this as an attempt by the left to simply play the long game. In other words, the longer the battles drag on, and they still have the seminaries maybe and the agencies maybe, and they have the support maybe of the mainstream press and the culture, which has changed on these issues quite sharply, then more and more conservatives just begin to filter out the doors and head to the local megachurch. Or you have United Methodist churches who take this one-time opportunity when the General Conference approves this plan to exit. Now, they haven't been told yet what they get to keep when they exit. Do they get to keep their endowments? Do they get to keep their buildings and property, which normally would belong to the denomination? So that's option number one. Option number two is really interesting, and I have to admit, it strikes me, this is where it puts the humor in the word united. They are proposing the creation of three different coast-to-coast conferences that literally are organized by their doctrine on gay rights. So there would be a liberal, an openly liberal conference, and at the bottom of this, there would be an openly conservative conference that wants to follow the existing doctrines of the church. And in the middle would be conferences that can't make up their mind, but they think they can live with local option. So did you follow that?
Yeah.
You've got openly pro-gay. In the middle, you have, we can't settle this, so we're all going to agree to hug each other and keep contributing, putting money in the offering plates and hang in there together. And then at the bottom you have, we actually like the doctrines of the church we've had for decades, affirming traditions that go back a long time. I think we'll go ahead and stay where we are. Now, what's fascinating is the bishop said, let me read you just a little bit of this language. Under this plan, United Methodists would share doctrine, services, and one council of bishops, while also creating different branches. Well, how would they share doctrine and services and a council of bishops if within the same church they all agree to completely different ordination standards and different standards for marriage? Does that strike you as, dare I say, kind of strange from a sacramental perspective if you happen to be in an ancient church that thinks about sacraments? It's a really weird plan. Then the third plan, the one that they kind of like the, oh yeah, we could have this too plan, is what people are calling the traditionalist model, when actually all it is would be to keep the church's polity and its doctrines where they are right now. I thought it was fascinating that they didn't come out with a fourth option, which would be everybody's going to go to the left, and if you don't like that, then we'll give you a chance to leave. I think a key factor here, though, is how do they continue their current denomination if the liberal sections of the churches are, to be perfectly blunt about it, not making converts or babies at the same rate as the growing sections of the church here in America or in other parts of the world? How do they keep the doors open without the money from the more traditional and larger conferences? Does that make sense? It's a huge, complex puzzle, but the left is playing to try to hold things together, sort of, long enough to keep the show on.
What eventually happened in a somewhat, although not entirely parallel situation in the Episcopal Church here in the United States was, and most recently, was that entire diocese just exited.
Right.
They were willing to do the legal battle over the properties and all those kinds of things, but they simply left. They kind of cobbled together a Anglican diocese in parallel to the Episcopal Church that is, you know, kind of struggling along to figure out where exactly it stands with respect to worldwide Anglicanism.
Well, hold it. Let me correct you there. They're trying to figure out where they stand with Canterbury.
Right.
Most of the global South has already signaled that they consider this new Anglican communion in America,
the real one,
to be truly Anglican. But see, now there you can see the contrast with Methodism. There, this would be like saying that you were going to have a liberal Anglican body, a confused Anglican body, or a compromised body, and a traditional one. Yet at the same time, they're all in communion with each other. And they all accept each other's clergy, even though they have different ordination standards. That's what's really fascinating about the Methodist plan. They're proposing something that you can already look over at the Anglican situation and say, how is that going to work? How do you stay in communion with a large C with each other when you're divided on certain sacraments? Now, of course, Eucharistically, the Anglicans are a higher church in terms of the emphasis on priesthood than the Methodists. Yet, of course, at the same time, you've had numerous attempts in England to reunite Methodism and Anglicanism. So this dance could get more and more confusing. And you know out there that there are newspaper editors with journalists coming in telling them that this is a big story, and they're going, can you explain this to me in like under, give me the Twitter version of this? At which point you just can't. And you also have to admit that nobody thinks this is going to be settled anytime soon. I mean, if they pass something at this general conference, and it's either option, it's either the local option, or it's the three parallel churches on top of each other option. If either one of those happen, all heck is going to break loose with about a third of the North American church that is openly evangelical. And the story will roll on.
My experience as a clergyman in the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod for the last 30 years has taught me that churches, the primary force in churches when they face something like this is inertia. What do you think the United Methodist Church will actually do?
Well, but see, remember, their polity links the number of people in the pews with how many votes you get. That means the left can't settle for inertia because they're in statistical decline. So that's the difference between this and Anglicanism. But I think the bigger message here that our listeners need to think about and that journalists need to think about is the simple fact that we're seeing over and over what the liberal former Southern Baptist ethicist David Gushee kind of, whether he meant to say it or not, he candidly said it a couple of years ago. He said, "This issue will come and find you. There is going to be no neutrality. He meaning the left, is not going to settle for letting this situation go on. The issue of sex outside of marriage and the definition of marriage, this issue will come and find you, and there will be nowhere to hide." And that certainly, as long as the mainstream press continues to stress it as much, that just turns the burner up under this already boiling pot.
If someone were to step back and get kind of the bigger picture of those seven sisters, mainline Protestantism in the United States, in the case of United Methodist Church, we're obviously talking about an international denomination mm-hmm. as well, global denomination. But if someone were to say, this is what mainline Protestantism in America is facing today, is the United Methodist Church essentially just that in microcosm?
It is, but I have to stress again, their polity makes the whole story more urgent. And the fact, well, there are growing Anglican churches in other parts of the world, but they don't have votes in meetings in America that determine things like property and pensions and agency jobs and whatever. The Methodist structure makes this thing more urgent. So they are, on one level, yes, you're right. This is a way to look at the seven sisters and just watch it all happen and say, this is it all in a nutshell. But on another level, they're not. Because in the Episcopal Church and in many other of the mainline Protestant bodies, they don't have this same mechanism that keeps turning the screw to make the conflict come to an end. At some point, there's going to be more Methodists in Africa and in the Bible Belt than there are in Colorado and New Hampshire and Massachusetts and whatever. And so the Massachusetts bishop wrote a prayer that he asked his people to say about all this. And that the opening of that prayer really lets you hear this whole thing kind of in a symbolic nutshell. His prayer begins, "God help us. Help us to take the next faithful step forward, not based on doctrine, tradition, or theology. Judgment, fears, or convictions, notions of who are the righteous and the unrighteous. Not based on doctrine, tradition, or theology, or notions." Interesting choice of word. Notions about who is right and who is wrong in terms of moral theology. That's what the left is feeling right now. That's what they feel like they're up against. They're literally up against doctrine, tradition, and theology.
Well, then with only a minute, Terry, what's the lesson to be learned? Laying aside, of course, kind of the exceptional case of their polity, what's the lesson to be learned in other American denominations who may not be part of the mainline group?
Oh, mercy. We're already watching the emergence of the evangelical left. I think they all need to be hearing David Gushee's words ringing in their ears. If you're at Christian colleges, if you're at seminaries, if you're at book publishing companies, if you're at parachurch groups, mission agencies, wherever you are, this issue will come and find you. Maybe even in the Missouri Synod in some subtle way. But the issue will come and find you, either through lawsuits, either through controversies, through debates or whatever. You're going to have to make up your mind how you get an authority of tradition, doctrine, or Bible that gives you beliefs you're willing to defend in public life on these hot-button issues. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, you could be having the exact same fights about, is the resurrection real, the virgin birth, or a lot of other doctrines. But we live in the age post-sexual revolution, and everybody's going to have to come up with a plan of how they're going to live and how they're going to defend it. There's nowhere to hide.
Terry Mattingly, a senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
On the other side of the break, Wesley Smith will join us, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. We're going to be talking about a declaration in support of conscientious objection in healthcare and why it is needed now. Stay tuned.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. This glorious good news is and always has been too good not to share. It compelled Peter, Paul, and the other apostles to the very ends of the earth, and it continues to drive Lutheran Church Missouri Synod missionaries even today. Learn more here in the April issue of The Lutheran Witness magazine. Subscribe today at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
People are talking about the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Lutheran FCU was created solely to serve LCMS workers, families, and entities, and proceeds benefit LCMS organizations. Lutheran FCU offers deposit accounts and loans and has service access at thousands of branches and ATMs nationwide. Lutheran FCU also offers members Christian-based lending advice for new loans and refinancing, minimal account fees, and superior personalized service. Check them out at LutheranFCU.org.
40 Years Greatly Blessed is this year's theme at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment and provide an alternative to secular public high schools. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a special 40th anniversary tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the giving page. Or call me, Dr. Jay Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
How did Christian communities in the past respond to godless cultures? The Issues Etc. book of the month for March is titled Embracing Godly Character, The Christian Community's Response to a Godless Culture. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or learn more about Embracing Godly Character at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month, Embracing Godly Character, 1-800-325-3040.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.